This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margo Patterson.
We'll be talking about international law as it applies to the war going on between Israel and Hamas today. But first, news briefs. Human Rights Watch has verified Israel's use of white phosphorus munitions in military operations in Gaza and Lebanon. White phosphorus is a chemical that can ignite structures, fields, people, and objects. In people, it can both burn the skin down to the bone and cause organ failure. The Middle East and North Africa Director of Human Rights Watch said white phosphorus poses a high risk of excruciating burns and lifelong suffering. The Israeli Air Force announced 5 days after the Hamas attack on Israel October 7th that it had dropped 6,000 bombs on Gaza, more bombs dropped in a week than the United States dropped in a year in Afghanistan. Since the Air Force announcement October 12th, Israeli airstrikes have continued. While the world's attention is focused on Gaza, as of October 18th, at least 64 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank since the war began. The escalating death count includes several killings by settlers firing at Palestinians at point-blank range. I'm speaking today to Michael Link, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Western Ontario in Canada. From 2016 to 2022, he served as UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied by Israel since 1967. Michael Link, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure, Margo.
Hamas's brutal attack on Israel October 7th clearly violates the rules of war. 1,400 Israelis were killed, most civilians. In Gaza, the death count reported as of a few hours ago today, October 17th, was 2,800 with 9,700 people wounded. Those numbers are sure to rise. Hundreds of thousands of people in Gaza have been displaced. Talk to us about the retaliation Israel is taking. What does international law say about Israel's bombing of the Gaza Strip and its tightening siege, preventing food, fuel, and electricity from entering the enclave?
As you said, the Hamas attack on Israel, with its killing of hundreds and probably over 1,000 Israeli civilians, is surely a war crime, as is the firing of missiles by Hamas into populated Israeli civilian neighborhoods and cities, as is the kidnapping and holding hostage of several hundred Israeli civilians. But we have to keep in mind that war crimes committed by one side does not give leave to the other side to commit war crimes in reply. As you've mentioned, that the death toll in Gaza is around 2,800 civilians, thousands wounded, many hundreds of thousands displaced and moving south, where there really isn't very much shelter. International law does not stay mute in situations like this. The firing of Israeli tank shells or missiles into civilian areas in Gaza with the expected death toll of civilians is very likely a war crime as well. One IDF spokesperson said late last week that the aim is destruction, not precision. A core principle of international humanitarian law is the protection of civilians and the making of a distinction between combatants and civilians. If you lose that, if you wind up making what would be indiscriminate attacks with huge civilian death tolls, then you're as likely to be standing in the docket of a court as would Hamas be if international law was able to bring you to a court. As well, the siege that was brought upon Gaza this time last week by cutting off all food, water, fuel, and electricity also is a grave breach of international humanitarian law. Starvation is prohibited as a tactic or weapon by a military party to a conflict, as is the deprivation of the necessities of life to a civilian population in a combat zone. So all of this raises grave issues of international law on both sides. And we've been through here before, if I can say this, Margot, to try to complete the answer. In 2008, 2009, again in 2014, and again during what was called the Great March of Return in 2018, there were huge numbers of civilian Palestinian deaths. On each of those three occasions, the Human Rights Council of the United Nations in Geneva commissioned an independent report. And in each of those three reports said that war crimes were likely committed by both sides, by Hamas in 2008, 09, and 2014, and by Israel in all three of those instances. So we have, if you like, mounting and precedential evidence with respect to what's gone on in the recent past. And yet, international law remains mute in many distressing ways. International law is the promise that states make to each other and to its citizens that they're going to obey modern treaties and conventions, particularly those which protect human rights and civilians. And yet we see in the Middle East, international law, unfortunately, is closer to power than it is to justice.
Gaza has been under a punishing siege since 2007. Israel has never declared the conditions in which it would lift the siege. I'm wondering if you could talk about the background to that siege and its legality under international law. I've heard some say it's illegal and others say that's not the case.
A couple of points to make then in reply to your very astute question. One is that Gaza remains occupied. In 2005, Israel withdrew its 8,000 settlers and its army from Gaza and then closed the gates and said the occupation is over. The United Nations disagrees with that, and so do most large human rights organizations, as well as the International Committee of the Red Cross. They all say that even though there are no more Israeli military boots on the ground inside Gaza, because of a 16-year-old siege that began in 2007 after Hamas took power in the Gaza Strip, where Israel has imposed a comprehensive land, sea, and air blockade, the United Nations has said Gaza remains occupied for the purposes of international humanitarian law and the Fourth Geneva Convention, and it remains an integral part of the occupied Palestinian territory. So what's happened over the last 16 years leading up to October 7th? This siege has been declared by both the former and the present UN Secretary Generals as collective punishment. I myself, in one of my reports when I was a special rapporteur, also declared this to be collective punishment of the civilian population in Gaza. And I pointed out that collective punishment is strictly prohibited by Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. What did this all mean to Gaza? It meant that unemployment was between 45 and 50% of the population. The World Bank, which monitors Gaza, said this is the highest unemployment rate in any geographic unit that it winds up covering. There are collapsing healthcare system in Gaza, under-resourced in terms of doctors and nurses, the inability to bring in medical equipment for modern treatment, the inability to bring in enough pharmaceuticals to be able to serve the population. Water, 97% of the coastal aquifer under Gaza is contaminated and unfit for human consumption because of the infiltration of sewage and seawater. This means that Gaza is dependent upon water coming from Israel and also water being produced by a desalination plant. Food, 80% of the population in Gaza is dependent in whole or in part on international food assistance coming in there. We have already, before October 7th, a large humanitarian crisis. The UN issued several reports in 2012 and 2017, which said that Gaza by 2020 would be unlivable. We're now 3 years after that date, and Gaza is indeed unlivable for the 2.3 million Palestinians who live there, who David Cameron, the former British Prime Minister, said live in an open-air prison. So all of that was the evidence that I think the UN Secretary Generals and as well as myself, a special rapporteur, used to come to the conclusion that this was collective punishment and illegal under international law.
On Sunday, October 15th, the Egyptian president said that Israel's activity in Gaza had exceeded its right to self-defense and had become collective punishment. What does the right to self-defense cover?
The right to self-defense covers the ability to defend yourself against an external attack. And Israel likely had a right to defend itself in the aftermath of the Hamas attack on October 7th and October 8th. But it must do that within the strict laws of war. Almost all European and North American leaders do say is that Israel has the right to defend itself, but it must be within the rules of international law. I do not hear them saying any extra emphasis with respect to the second half of that statement, because as I've indicated, Israel has probably clearly exceeded its ability to defend itself legitimately within the strict boundaries of international law by the indiscriminate bombing that is conducted in northern Gaza and the mass human depopulation of internally displaced people, numbering probably close to a million, who've had to flee Gaza City and the large refugee camps in the north going south. I would agree with the Egyptian pronouncement that Israel has exceeded its right to self-defense. I would probably say more than the Egyptians, saying this is more than simply collective punishment. These are actually war crimes in Israel's inability or refusal or negligence in not distinguishing between civilians and combatants.
Let me ask you more about that move that some people are taking from the north to the south. Israel warned that those living in the north should evacuate to the south ahead of expected ground battles in and around Gaza City. The UN has said it's impossible for 1 million people to evacuate in such a short period of time. Being unreasonable, of course, may not be illegal, but the forced transfer of civilians under occupation is a war crime, I believe. Does Israel's warning to, or its demand to civilians to leave the north, does this constitute the forcible transfer of civilians?
It may well do that. You know, part of it depends upon what the outcome of all of this is. You can imagine that in Gaza, somewhere between 70 to 75% of the population of Gaza are either refugees from 1948 or the descendants of refugees from 1948. So there is a very rich and dark historical memory of trauma, of being forced to flee from their communities in southern, what was then southern Palestine, into the Gaza Strip, thinking they would be there for weeks or perhaps a few months until hostilities ended in 1948, and then been forbidden to leave Gaza to return to their homes over this course of 75 years. So the historical trauma of being forced to leave from northern Gaza to southern Gaza, where itself has not been safe. There has been ongoing Israeli airstrikes throughout the center and the south of Gaza, where these internally displaced are moving in their hundreds of thousands. And I must add as well that given how poor a society Gaza is, with a GDP measured in U.S. terms of, I think, about $1,250 a year, and with the UN already stretched before October 7th in terms of its ability to deliver humanitarian services, there now is this humanitarian catastrophe in the south. The buildings and the open areas where these hundreds of thousands of Palestinians are fleeing to have no capacity to be able to give them the kind of humanitarian support that they need. There's virtually no water in that area. There's no food in that area. There's no safety in that area. And for many of them, they're camping with whatever they brought on their backs in open areas. The UN schools and health clinics and other buildings are overwhelmed with several hundred thousand Palestinians sheltering in them, with breakdown in sanitation and the inability to provide even the most basic of services. We know that there are trucks and trucks filled with humanitarian aid on the Egyptian side of the Gaza-Egyptian border at Rafah, unable to be able to come in with water, food, tents, clothing, and other desperately needed humanitarian aid. So we're at a peak crisis point with respect to the humanitarian crisis that we're seeing unfolding in front of our eyes.
If you're just joining us, this is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margo Patterson, and I'm speaking to Michael Link about international law and the conduct of the war now taking place between Israel and Hamas. From 2016 to 2022, Michael Link served as UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied by Israel since 1967. Our conversation was recorded October 17th.
The Biden administration is giving unequivocal, full-throated support to the Israeli war against Hamas and is planning to send more weapons to Israel as soon as Congress approves them. Biden has said he is confident Israel will abide by the rules of war. I think you're suggesting that it is not abiding by the rules of war. Has it done so in the past? Where does Biden get his confidence that Israel will abide by these rules?
It would have been my great hope that that Joe Biden, in going to Israel on Wednesday, would have been there to be the adult in the room, to offer a way out by calling and demanding a ceasefire, by beginning to chart both a short-term supply of desperately needed humanitarian aid to the Palestinians and bringing a end to the current hostilities, and then charting forward the way to a compassionate peace based on international law. I'm afraid Joe Biden, trained as he is as a lawyer, has ignored all of the recent findings that have strongly suggested that Israel has been in violation of international law in its conduct of its prior major assaults on Gaza over the last 15 years. And certainly every indication now is that it is in breach of these solemn obligations this time. We have a statement coming from the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, which is suggesting very strongly that international law has been breached by Israel in its conduct of the current war. And one would just have to ask yourself a very simple common sense question. If 2,800 Palestinians or civilians have been killed in the period of 8 or 9 days through an intensive shelling and missile strikes through densely populated neighborhoods in an overcrowded population strip, why wouldn't that cause all of us, not simply lawyers, to say, isn't there something wrong with this picture? Isn't this what international law in its modern form is meant to prevent, this mass killing of civilians? I fear that with Israel now being ruled by its most right-wing government ever, and that's saying quite a bit in Israeli politics, that they are only going to draw comfort from the visit of Joe Biden to, if you like, finish the job, which is not only eliminating Hamas at a huge price, but it may mean the real possibility of thousands and thousands of more dead, and perhaps the permanent displacement of some or all of the population in Gaza.
I spoke to your predecessor as UN Special Rapporteur this morning, Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University, Chairman of the Board of Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, an independent nonprofit organization for the protection of human rights. He spoke very strongly against what the Biden administration is doing and says the Biden administration is complicit in Israeli war crimes. Do you agree with him?
Of course. What an adult in the room would be calling for now is an immediate ceasefire. The evidence is so apparent with respect to the horrors on the ground, the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. And if Joe Biden's visit only encourages more of this, then it's impossible to say that the U.S. is not complicit in this. Indeed, there is no conflict in the modern world where international law has spoken so regularly and so insistently, and there's no occupation in the world that has lasted as long as this, 56 years and counting. Yet there's no occupation or crisis point in the world where international law has been so sidelined. And that is largely due to the actions of the United States. The United States acts as not only Israel's primary military supplier by giving them $3.8 billion a year in military aid, but also acting as a diplomatic shield, particularly when difficult issues like this arise and are dealt with at the UN Security Council. There was a vote yesterday on a resolution advanced by Russia to call for an immediate ceasefire, and it was voted down with the United States opposing it. I've not heard the United States say there should be a ceasefire. So if Joe Biden is not calling for a ceasefire, then what he's calling for is more of the same in Gaza. This will only wear even thinner the reputation of the United States in many parts of the world, that it is not a defender of international law or the rule of law, and that it is quite blinkered when it comes to human rights. If I can add something, in his very eloquent memoir, former President Barack Obama said in 2020, in his presidential memoir, that the price we paid as the United States for constantly defending Israel cost us plenty in the international diplomatic arena. Whenever we raised questions with respect to human rights violations in China or in Iran, we were always confronted in turn with, well, what about human rights violations by Israel of Palestinian rights? And he said, here we were in an international arena defending Israel for actions that we ourselves opposed. So this can only add, I think, to the diplomatic stain that the United States continues to wear on the international arena when it defends so completely Israel's actions.
Are Western nations, are any of them speaking out strongly against what is going on, or are they too being silent?
Yeah, my country is not speaking out with respect to what is going on in Gaza, aside from fingers crossed, please don't violate international law. Europe is divided. I did see a commendable statement today by the president of Ireland, who said that what Israel is doing in Gaza goes beyond all human and legal terms with regard to their ability to be able to defend themselves. So I'm pleased to see that Michael Higgins offers a clear moral voice in the modern world. I just wish he wasn't so lonely in saying that.
What accounts for the paralysis within the international community? Yes, the United States has tremendous power. Is it that alone that keeps people silent about Israeli crimes, or are there other factors?
Very strong support given to Israel by the United States certainly explains a lot of this. I think Europe and many other parts of the world would be much more critical of Israel and much more insistent upon Israel bringing itself within the compliance of UN resolutions and international law if it were not for the United States. For many countries, mine, Canada, and in Europe, there is, to be fair, there is the always the recognition of the Holocaust, and that the creation of Israel was, if you like, the solace that the West gave to the remnants of European Jewry for the enormous genocide inflicted upon them. But they never truly count on the price paid for the creation of the State of Israel, which was the cleansing of much of the Palestinian population from where they lived and the political orphanage of the Palestinians over the past 75 years. We're left with this dilemma of two peoples, both with strong historical traumas, trying, wishing, wanting to find some way to a compassionate peace, and the international community having, if you like, laid out what the path is through international law, but then refusing to back up international law with international resolve.
Some people are warning of ethnic cleansing in the Gaza Strip. Some people are warning of genocide. Could you clarify what those terms mean under international law and whether you think either of those terms applies to what is going on now or what appears to lie ahead?
Ethnic cleansing, obviously, is a strict prohibition under international law, both under international humanitarian law, but also under international criminal law through the Rome Statute of 1998. It was commonplace perhaps 100 years ago or even 75 years ago to think that population exchanges or the thinning of a minority in a particular land was a smart political solution. We've come to the realization, rightly, that people have rights, both individual rights, but also collective rights, national rights, minority rights, where they wind up living. And you are not allowed to remove people from the land in the interest of creating a bigger national unit, say, for Germans or for Poles or for Russians or for anyone. Everybody has a right to the full protection of human rights law wherever it is that they are living. So the idea of ethnic cleansing is an idea that we thought we had addressed and put into the bin of illegality in the 20th century. And here we're still raising the issue of its possibility in the 21st century. And, you know, this is the possibility of this is a stain on the conscience of humanity.
My impression is that Egypt fears that if it opens the gates to people from Gaza coming in, that those people will never be allowed to return and they will stay in Egypt. A reasonable fear on Egypt's part?
Neither the Palestinian Authority nor Egypt wants to see Palestinians crossing in any great numbers into the Sinai. This would be, if you like, a dream of some on the Israeli right-wing political spectrum. Gaza has always been a problem for Israeli leaders. Some leaders have said they just wish Gaza would fall away into the sea. The idea of being able to use a moment like this, a horrific moment like this, to try to solve what Israel sees as a political problem as opposed to a challenge of justice by inviting, forcing hundreds of thousands or even several million Palestinians into the Sinai, maybe for temporary purposes, but with Israel, in many ways, temporary often becomes permanent. This would be ethnic cleansing. This would be, I think, an extraordinary challenge to the world, particularly those who support Israel. How do you justify a further cleansing of a people who already have this historical trauma? I mean, the Palestinians regard themselves, and I think quite rightly, as the victims of the victims. And if we're going to try to see our way to recognizing each other's common humanity, then a military solution is not on the cards, and cleansing of land, of its population, is not on the cards either.
I want to go back to that question about genocide. What's the understanding of genocide under international law, and do you think people's concerns about that happening are justified right now? Is it happening?
Sure. The issue of genocide, I know, is being discussed with respect to international law scholars and those who know a lot about the Genocide Convention of 1948. Essentially, the definition of genocide is the destruction in whole or in part of a people. And that can occur militarily, but it can also occur through through a range of other means of subjugation as well. I mean, genocide is talked about in your country and my country with respect to indigenous populations of an ongoing genocide. In Canada, the term often is used as how we use residential schools through the 20th century to try to get the Indian out of the indigenous population. And that's been more and more, at least in a common, in a popular sense, and probably in a legal sense as well, as genocide. What we could be seeing with respect to the Palestinians in Gaza might well be genocide if it means obviously large death toll combined with the expulsion from their homeland. That would raise the issue of whether or not the issue of genocide could be brought as a legal issue to the International Court of Justice. And I know ideas are floating around with respect to that, and it remains a live issue.
You mentioned earlier Israel's prior assaults on Gaza. The International Criminal Court seems paralyzed on the situation of Palestine. Why?
It is. It's a point of frustration to any international lawyer that pays attention to Israel and Palestine. The complaints with respect to potential war crimes committed by Israel were first laid in the winter of 2015. That's almost 9 years ago. Some people said, well, the sun rises slowly. Certainly in this case, it has. I know over the years, there has been more and more evidence being presented to prosecutor's office with respect to war crimes by Hamas, war crimes by Israel, and the file keeps on growing. But this has not been seen as a priority by the current chief prosecutor. He certainly sees the necessity of wanting to pursue war crimes investigations with respect to Russia and Ukraine. But putting Palestine on the back burner has not advanced the concept and the hope of justice and a rights-based approach in Israel and Palestine.
People who are aghast at the situation, what can they, should they be doing?
I suppose in the United States would be obviously writing your congressperson, writing your senator, writing your secretary of state to demand first and foremost a ceasefire. And don't let them get away with continuing to say, well, Israel is free to do what they want as long as they obey international law. It's obvious that international law is now being breached and breached in a horrific way. There's a strong sense that, yes, what Hamas did violated many, many norms in international law. But Israel is a law-abiding country that conducts its war through lawful means. That is not so. And we have so much evidence compiled, among others, by the United Nations and through these reports of the Human Rights Council that they haven't. And they're not today. So first and foremost, demand a ceasefire, and secondly, demand humanitarian aid getting to the displaced Palestinian population in Gaza.
Michael Link, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Margo. You take care and good luck.
I've been speaking to Michael Link, former UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied by Israel since 1967. You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine. If you'd like to hear the full interview, you can listen to our podcast or go to our program page on the KKFI website at kkfi.org and listen online.